worse than his bite. The throb of Charlie's motors was more fearsome than the thump of his bombs. Once the bombs were dropped, we would be relieved, knowing he would be off and away. But the drone of Charlie's circling progress kept everyone awake and uneasy for so long as Charlie cared or dared. Dawn meant departure for Charlie. For then our planes could rise to chastise him, and he would become visible to our anti-aircraft batteries. Charlie did not kill many people, but, like Macbeth, he murdered sleep. To these trials was added the worst ordeal, shelling from the sea. Enemy warships, usually cruisers, sometimes battleships, stand off your coast. It is night, and you cannot see them, nor could you if it were day, for they are miles and miles away. Our airplanes cannot rise at night to meet them. Our 75mm pack howitzers are as effectual as pop guns opposing rifles. The enemy has everything his way. We could see the flashes of the guns far out to sea. We heard the soft ba-boom, ba-boom of the salvos. Then rushing through the night, straining like an airy boxcar, came the huge projectiles. The earth rocks and shakes upon the terrifying crash of the detonation, though it be hundreds of yards away. Your stomach is squeezed, as though a monster hand were kneading it into dough. You gasp for breath like the football player who falls heavily and has the wind knocked out of him.
Flash.
Ba-boom.
Whew.
They're lowering their sights. It's coming closer. Oh, that one was close. Sandbags are falling. I can't hear it. I can't hear the shell. It's the one you don't hear, they say. The one you don't hear. Where is it? Where is it? Flash. Boom. Thank God. It's lifted. It's going the other way. Dawn blinks across the river. They go. The planes on the airstrip behind us rise in pursuit. We emerge from the pits. Someone says he is thankful the bombardment continued all night. For if it had ceased, an attack by land might have followed. Someone else calls him a fool. They argue. But nobody cares. It is daylight now, and there are only the bombings to worry about. And the heat. And the mosquitoes. And the rice lying in the belly like stones. The eyes are rounder. The tendency to stare is more pronounced. We hated working parties. We were weak with hunger. We manned the lines at night. By day, they formed us into working parties and took us to the airfield. We buried boxes of ammunition there, digging deep holes, lugging the 100-pound crates. We only got weaker. Once, returning from a working party, the bombers swept suddenly overhead. I fled before the crashing approach of the bombs they scattered throughout our grove. I leapt into a freshly dug slit trench with three others. I crouched there while roaring air squeezed my stomach. Behind me crouched another man, his face against my bare back. I felt his lips moving in prayer over my skin, the quivering kiss of fear and faith. When I returned to the pits, they told me that the other working party, the one that I had missed, had been obliterated by the bombs. That was when Manners died, and the gay Texan. Chuckler made corporal. He made it in a battlefield promotion. Lieutenant Ivy League had recommended him for a Silver Star for our work on the riverbank in the Hell's Point fight, specifying that our action in moving the gun from place to place may have discouraged an enemy flanking attack. The regimental commander reduced the citation to a promotion of one grade. Ivy League had not mentioned me in his recommendation. I have no idea why not. Though it was Chuckler who had first grabbed our gun, it was I who had proposed the moves, and Ivy League knew it. I resented being ignored, although I tried to conceal it, and Chuckler, embarrassed, did his best to pass over it, trying to make a joke of it. But he deserved both promotion and citation, for he was a born leader. I never forgave Ivy League, and I think this marked the beginning of my dislike for him. They brought us mosquito nets. We still slept on the ground, a poncho under us if it was dry, over us if it was raining. But the mosquito nets were a boon. Now we could use our blankets to sleep on, rather than to guard our head against mosquitoes. The poncho could be rolled up for a pillow. If it rained, it went over us. But the nets really came too late. We were full of malaria. They brought in supplies. Each squad got a toothbrush, a package of razor blades, and a bar of candy. We raffled them off. The runner won the candy bar. Despairing of dividing it among 10 men, he fell into a torment of indecision until everyone assured him he should eat it himself. He slunk off to the underbrush to do so. Oakstump continued to reinforce his private fort. Every time I saw him, it seemed he had an axe in his hand or a coconut log on his shoulder. Once he carried a log so huge that it gouged a hole in his shoulder, a wound which, in civilization, would have required stitching. Everyone kept saying hopefully that the army was coming in next week to relieve us. Everyone was in despair. We heard that the army relief force had been destroyed at sea. Chuckler and I visited the cemetery. It lay to the south, off the coastal road that ran from east to west through the coconuts. We knelt to pray before the graves of the men we had known. Only palm fronds marked the place where they were buried, although here and there were rude crosses, on which were nailed the men's identification tags. Some of the crosses bore mess gear tins, affixed to the wood-like rude medallions, and on those the Marines had lovingly carved their epitaphs. He died fighting. A real Marine. A big guy with a bigger heart. Our buddy. The harder the going, the more cheerful he was. There was this verse, which I have seen countless times, before and since. The direct and unpolished cry of a Marine's sardonic heart. And when he gets to heaven to St. Peter, he will tell, "One more Marine reporting, sir. I've served my time in hell." Other inscriptions, and most often the dead man's name, were made by pressing bullets into the ground, so that the round brass end of the cartridges gleamed above the earth. Chuckler and I lifted our gaze from the cemetery to encompass the entire level plain sweeping back to the hills. Chuckler raised his eyebrows sardonically. "Plenty of room," he said. "That's for sure," I said. We said a prayer before the grave of one of the dead from our own platoon. "You know," Chuckler said, rising, "he had $200 in his kick before Hell's Point. He won it in a poker game." "Yeah?" "When they went to bury him, he didn't have a dime." We plotted the death of a rat that had become attached to our machine gun pit. We swore we would kill it and have fresh meat. Its habit was to scurry across the gun embrasure, almost flitting. It moved so fast in the half-light. It seemed the rat grew bolder as we grew weaker from hunger, until, in our extremity, it actually sauntered across the embrasure. We never caught it. If we had, I doubt that we would have eaten it. One night we were shelled by cruisers. A projectile landed in the river mud not far from us. The pit shook like jelly. No one spoke, until Nobehind said hopefully, "Must be a dud." I said, "Didn't you ever hear of a delayed fuse?" And everybody giggled, except Nobehind, who drew his breath sobbingly. I had to slap him. Another night, a very black night, we huddled in the pits while the sounds of battle came to us from the hills on our right. We were alerted for an attack. We sat wonderingly the whole night, all of it, until morning brought the news that the first half of the Battle of Bloody Ridge had been fought. The Japs had been repulsed. When night fell again, the battle was resumed. We sat again in the black pit, waiting. This time there was almost no crackling of small arms fire, only the thump and crash of artillery. Our artillery, we hoped. We took turns peering from the pit for signs of the enemy on our front, or crawled out on the riverbank for a better look. We could only hope the raiders and paramarines would hold. Up there in that black and scarlet hell, where the issue had become so close that our own artillery was falling upon our own positions, abandoned by the defending Marines and overrun by the attackers. It was a most unbelievable barrage our 105 millimeters threw out. I was nowhere near either end of it, yet it made my teeth ache. Morning was a blessing. It chased away fear of the Japanese breaking our line up in the hills, pouring through the gap, spilling into the groves behind us. We knew the Japs had been beaten. Strange how the anxiety of that vigil could be almost as wearing as the actual fight. The Hoosier said it next day. We were gathered in the shade of the only tree on the riverbank. Hoosier sat leaning against the trunk, whittling on a stick. He kept on plying the stick with his knife, slicing off long, curly slivers of white wood, seeming not to care whether or not anyone heeded his words. "They're gonna whittle us," he said, shaping his sentences proportionate to the slivers. "They come in last night against the raiders, same as they come in against us. Sure we beat 'em, so'd the raiders. But every time we lose a few chips, every time we lose a couple hundred men, what do they care what they lose? Life is cheap with them. They got plenty more anyway." He waved the stick. "They got plenty of sticks, but we just got the one. We just got us. Fella from the 5th came by this morning and said the Japs was unloading 2 more troop transports down at Kokum. They keep on whittling us. Every day we lose 10, 20 fellows from the bombing. Every night Washing Machine Charlie gets a couple. When they hit us with them battleships, I don't know how many we lose. But they got it all their own way," he continued, grunting as the knife cut into a hard spot. "'Cause we ain't got no ships and we ain't got no airplanes except a couple of Grummans that can't get off the ground half the time because we ain't got no gasoline. They got the ships and they got the airplanes and it looks like they got the time, too. So I'm telling you," the knife cut through and the stick broke, "they're gonna whittle us." The chuckler sought to make a joke of it. "What's eating you? You never had it so good. Here's a guy getting lamb's tongue in his rice and he wants to get back to civilization and stand in them long lines for his war bonds. What do you want? Egg in your beer?" "Don't be a damn fool, chuckler. I'm not kidding. They're gonna wear us down." "No egg in my beer," said the runner. "Just give it to me straight. Let me have mine in a nice tall glass like they have at the Statler. Carling's. Carling's Black Label." Hoosier arose and looked down at us with a glance of wearied exasperation. He strode away, and we sat there in silence. We felt like theology students whose instructor takes his leave after presenting the most compelling arguments against the existence of God. Our faith in victory had been unquestioning. Its opposite, defeat, had no currency among us. Victory was possible, that was all. It would be easy or difficult, quick or prolonged, but it would be victory. So here came the disturbing Hoosier, displaying the other side of the coin, showing us defeat. It shook us, and it was from this moment that we dated the feeling of what is called expendability. All armies have expendable items, that is, a part or unit, the destruction of which will not be fatal to the whole. In some ordeals, a man might consider his finger expendable, but not his hand, or, in extremity, his arm, but not his heart. There are expendable items which may be lost or destroyed in the field, either in peace or in war, without their owner being required to replace them. A rifle is so expendable, or a cartridge belt. So are men. Men are the most expendable of all. Hunger, the jungle, the Japanese. Not one nor all of these could be quite as corrosive as the feeling of expendability. This was no feeling of dedication because it was absolutely involuntary. I do not doubt that if the Marines had asked for volunteers for an impossible campaign such as Guadalcanal, almost everyone now fighting would have stepped forward. But that is sacrifice. That is voluntary. Being expended robs you of the exaltation, the self-abnegation, the absolute freedom of self-sacrifice. Being expended puts one in the role of victim rather than sacrificer, and there is always something begrudging in this. I doubt if Isaac would have accepted the knife of his father, Abraham, entirely without reproach, yet, for the same master, he would have gone gladly to his death 1,000 times. The world is full of the sacrifices of heroes and martyrs. But there was only one victim. If we were to be victims, we were as firmly secured to our role as Isaac bound to the faggots. No day passed without accentuating it.
Lieutenant, when are we getting off this island?
Search me, I don't know.
Couldn't you ask the colonel?
What makes you think he knows?
This food is rotten, Lieutenant.
Yeah, I know, but you better eat it.
I can't take another mouthful of this wormy rice.
Eat it.
But how can they expect us to...
Eat it.
But it gags me.
Okay, don't.
I think I got malaria. Here, feel my forehead.
Jeez, I think you're right. It's hot as hell. You ought to turn into the sick bay.
Nah, why not? What's the point? They'll only give me some aspirin. If my fever gets real bad, they'll only put me in a tent with the rest of the bad ones. They won't let me go home. They won't take me off the island. Nobody leaves, so what's the point?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Sure I'm right. So I'd rather suffer among friends. I'm telling you, nobody's leaving this island. Not even in a pine box. You can say that again. Ain't we got our own cemetery?
It was so lonely. It was the loneliness of the night watch, listening to the myriad moving things and straining to detect, beneath this irregular rhythm of nature, the regular sound of man. Loneliness. This was the pit that yawned beneath our yearning, our constant reproach of the world at large. In another sense, in an almost mawkish sense, we had gotten hold of the notion that we were orphans. No one cared, we thought. All of America's millions doing the same things each day, going to movies, getting married, attending college commencements, sales meetings, cafe fires, newspaper drives against vivisection, political oratory, Broadway hits and Broadway flops, horrible revelations in high places and murders in tenements making tabloid headlines, vandalism in cemeteries and celebrities getting religion, all the same. All the changeless daily America. All of this was going on without a single thought for us. This was how we thought. It seems silly now, but it was real enough then. And I think we might have become unwarrantably bitter alongside that evil river. Had there not come at last a tearing, liberating change, we were ordered to new positions. We left the river. We left without notice. We swung our packs onto our backs and our guns onto our shoulders and walked over the wooden bridge where the Teneroo doubles back, past a crocodile lair, and up a hill, and down into the fields. 4. It was a respite. The fields were like a midweek holiday that saves a job from drudgery. It was a recess, a winter vacation. Fear seemed almost to vanish. It was as though we were members of an archaeological mission, or hunting party. Only the absence of lights at night reminded us of the triune foe, the dark, the jungle, and the Jap. Even the terrible heat in these stifling fields of kunai grass could not distress us, for we had built our machine gun pit twice the size of its predecessors on the Teneroo, and could take refuge in its cool confines. Our pit was indeed a fort, perhaps as big as a kitchen, 6 feet or more down. Overhead were double thicknesses of logs. A few inches of dirt, and a heavy sodding of wild grass which took root almost as soon as we had planted it, and which, from 100 feet distant, gave the pit the aspect of a hillock. With our great field of fire rolling away from us like the vast, unharvested sea, and with our nasty network of barbed wire like a wicked shoal to ensnare the unwary, we felt that we need reckon with only a direct hit from a bomber or a battleship. We retired behind our defenses to loaf and to nurse our tropical ulcers. This is a name which we conferred upon any running or festering sore, and most especially upon those which ate into the outer covering of the bone. There were few of us whose legs and hands were not dappled with these red and white rosettes of pain, red with blood, white with pus, and often ringed with the black of feeding flies. Yet, there was luxury in the fields. We had beds. A supply of Japanese rope had been discovered in our area. We made beds with it, driving logs into the ground to shape an oblong, and plaiting a mattress of the rope.
What comfort! Dry, warm, and above the ground.
No mere voluptuary in his bed of feathers and satin, with his canopy stretching silkily overhead, with his bell pull next to his hand and his mistress curled at his feet, could have surpassed us for pure pleasure. Chuckler and the Hoosier slept alongside each other, erecting their beds only inches apart, as did all other watchmates, such as Runner and myself. Their beds were about a dozen yards distant in the scrub between the pits and the jungle. It seemed that almost every night, while Runner and I lay whispering to each other, we would hear the thunderous progress of a land crab through the brush. We would hear, too, the snoring of the Hoosier, and we would cease to whisper and wait. Then there would be silence, like the pause between notes of music. It would be broken, simultaneously, by an indignant shriek from Hoosier, a shout of laughter from the Chuckler, and an unbelievable clatter and crash that was the land crab scuttling to safety.
"Damn it, Chuckler, it ain't funny! What's the matter, Chuckler? What happened?"
That would be Runner, his voice strangled with suppressed laughter.
"It's the crab again. Hoosier's crab. It came through again and cut the rope and pinched Hoosier's ass."
Hoosier's reply shocked the night, but laughter rose up to assuage the injury, great shouts of it leaping skyward, until even the aggrieved Hoosier could not remain aloof. Now how can a man be frightened with things like this happening around him? Our airplanes had begun to challenge Japanese supremacy in the air above us. Aerial dogfights raged daily over Henderson Field. And because we were in such proximity to the airstrip, many were above our pits. But we had now such a well-developed fear of airplanes that we would not come above ground so long as the bombers lingered or the shrapnel of anti-aircraft bursts kept falling. Only Skarchen persisted in what had once been a general delight in watching the show. He sat on the roof of the pit, ejaculating like a child at the circus, stirring not a foot even when the thump of the bombs was dangerously close, or when we in the pit below could hear the tinkle of falling shrapnel or the whiz of bomb fragments. He supplied us with a running description of the battle.
"Oh boy, there goes one!"
We would hear the shriek of a plunging plane, then a shattering blast.
"Oh, that must have been a 500-pounder. Hey, Chuckler, Lucky, come on up. You don't know what you're missing."
"The hell we don't,"
Chuckler growled, and then raising his voice,
"What do you mean there goes one? Whose?"
"Ours."
We would exchange raised eyebrows. The Runner or someone would shake his head.
"The bastard doesn't care who wins. Look at him! Look at him! They got him! They've got him on the run! The Japs are running! They're taking off!"
Sometimes, in exasperation, or when the bombs came closer than usual, someone would shout up to him,
"Come on down here, Skarchen! Come on, you crazy bastard, before you get your ass blown off!"
Skarchen would chortle,
"What's the difference? They can knock it off down there, too! Makes no difference where you are. If you're gonna get it, you're gonna get it. And there isn't anything you can do about it. When your number comes up, that's it, brother. So why worry?"
There was no arguing with him, nor with his fellow fatalists. Kismet was all the fashion on Guadalcanal. You could hear them saying, "It is written," in 100 different ways. "Why worry? You'll go when your time comes." Poor Bill. It must have been his time to go.
Whew!
I sure thought that one had my number on it. There is almost no argument against fatalism. Argue until you are weary, but men like Skarchen still lounge among the falling bombs. Tell them they don't believe it, when they say, "You go when your time comes." Suggest that it is they, through their own foolhardiness, who choose the time. Impress upon them that they are their own executioner, that they pull their own name out of the hat. Remind them that even if it is fatalism that they want, as opposed to common sense, they still must choose it. They must even choose no choice. It is a fine argument, an excellent way to pass the time while the bombs fall and Skarchen, that disturbing fatalist Skarchen, lounges above without a word of rebuttal, himself alone among the exploding steel. On a hot day, I withdrew from the mud-floored pit to the thin shade of the scrub, where I threw myself face downward to nap. I awoke with the earth trembling beneath me. I awoke sweating with fear. The earth quivered, and I knew it to be an earthquake. I was horrified that the earth might open beneath me and swallow me up. I was disappointed that it did not, that I saw no great fissures. Perdition must be like this. The earth opening, the final betrayal, the nothingness under the feet, and the eternal wailing plunge. My belly was rumbling so with hunger and gas that the runner complained he could not sleep at night. He mistook it for the faraway thunder of enemy battleships. One night I awoke to hear him scrambling from his sack and racing for the pit. "Everybody up!" he shouted. "Everybody up! It's the battleships again!" "Hey, runner!" I hollered at him. "Get back here, before you blow your top. That's no battleship. That's my belly." He came back, cursing me half-heartedly, a sort of sheepish, hopeless imprecation. Of course, Runner had good cause to fear battleships whenever he heard a muffled rumbling. While we were in the fields, the shelling from the sea rose to a thunderous pitch. The earth would quiver beneath those blows. And they were nearer here than on the river. The first salvo was as sudden and unexpected as an earthquake. No one ever heard its ghostly baboom, baboom, far out to sea, nor heard the rushing of projectiles through the air until that triple tearing crash of the detonating shells rent sleep as the screech of breaking tires rends the serenity of the living room. Hateful cursing in the dark, feet pelting to the pit, struggling and jostling at the entrance like New Yorkers in the subway. Another night lost, another sleep conceded to the enemy. They were still whittling us. We had been nearly 2.5 months on Guadalcanal the night the worst shelling came, and I remember it chiefly because it was the night I nearly panicked. The crash of the first shells tore so suddenly into a deep sleep that I could not control myself. It seemed they had exploded in my back pocket. The next ones surely would make bits of me. I clawed frantically at my mosquito net. I tried to butt my way through it, tried to bull through gossamer. Then the next cluster landed, no nearer than the first. I drew breath and lay stock still for a moment, as though to straighten out of the panting pretzel into which panic had twisted me. Deliberately, I reached beneath me to clutch the mosquito net at the bottom of the fold and lift it free. Carefully, I climbed out. Determinedly, I stood erect. Then I kicked myself in the behind and walked to the pit. It was the worst shelling, but I slept through it. Having regained control of myself, having been spared the stigma of a public funk, I was completely confident and relaxed. I was unafraid. So I slept. Chuckler found papayas on the banks of the Ilu. We ate them in the morning before chow, while the cool of the night and the morning's moisture was in them. Lieutenant Ivy League heard of them, asked for some, and seeing we had finished them, organized a papaya party to go in search of these succulent melons. But there were no more papayas on the banks of the Ilu. Instead, we found something better. Our papaya parties became swimming parties. We would station sentries on the farther bank and take our pleasure in that wonderful river. It was the same one in which we had bathed and drunk the day of our landing, still swift, still cold, still a delight to hot and sweating flesh. The tropics has its own anodynes, what the modern world calls built-in. Such are the cool milk of the coconut, or the swift-running little rivers that come dancing down from the hills. Streams like the Ilu and the Lunga kept us in health. I have no statistics to support me, but my own observations were that those of us who bathed frequently in them were those least afflicted by ulcers or malaria. But our rediscovery of the Ilu came too late. We had had only a week of her charms when we were notified to stand by to move out. We were going to new positions. "The army's here."
"Like hell!
I'm telling you, they're here. I saw them myself."
It was the Chuckler, expostulating angrily with one hand, while the other clutched a white sack slung over his shoulder.
"I was down the beach at Lunga Point. I saw them land."
"What's in the sack?" asked the runner. The Chuckler grinned. He squatted on his haunches in the manner we had when there was nothing to sit on and the ground was muddy. and he began to laugh.
I never saw anything like it. I was down on the beach, right where the Lunga runs into the bay, and I saw their ships. Some of them were still coming ashore in LCTs, and there was a whole bunch of them in the coconut grove there, when suddenly somebody hollers, "Condition red!" Poor bastards, I felt sorry for them. They'd have a rough time the night before. That big naval shelling was for them. I heard the Japs got here too late to sink their transports, so they threw the stuff into the airfield anyway. It didn't hit the doggies, but it sure scared hell out of them. Anyway, they was in no condition for an air raid. They started digging and scrambling around. One of their officers gets a bright idea, and the next thing you know, they're all taken off for cover in the jungle. Chuckler's face crinkled. You should have seen it. It was the damnedest thing. No sooner are the doggies gone when a whole raggedy horde of gyrenes comes running out of the jungle. It was like it was staged. The doggies vanish into the jungle on one side. The planes come overhead and start bombing the airport. And these raggedy-ass marines come slipping out of the jungle on the other side and start looting everything the doggies left behind. Then Condition Yellow comes, and they melt right back into the jungle. The coconut grove looked like a cyclone hit it. When the doggies came back, half their stuff was gone.
It was a great joke on the dog faces and the sort of comedy marines enjoy most. You mean you was just watching this all the time? Asked the Hoosier disbelievingly.
Hell no. I just watched them pour out of the jungle. When I seen what they're doing, I joined in.
What'd you get? The Chuckler opened his bag, also stolen, and disclosed his swag. It was the plunder of a judicious thief. No frippery. No useless ornament or artifices of that artificial world back home, like electric shavers or gold rings or wallets. Nothing but solid swag of the sort that was without price on our island. Things like socks or t-shirts or bars of soap or boxes of crackers. That was what the Chuckler stole, and we applauded him as the men of Robin Hood might have sung the praises of Little John upon his return from a light-fingered excursion into Nottingham Town. It was but a few hours before we learned that this very army outfit was going to take our place in the lines. We were glad to hear it. Their arrival on Guadalcanal meant that we were no longer surrounded. Henceforth, contact with the outside world would be common. The fate of Wake Island no longer haunted us. Our navy was back. The worst that could happen to us now was Dunkirk. So we were glad to see the soldiers when they came trudging up to our pits. They came after another air raid, a very close one. But the thing had not infected them yet. War was still a lark. Their faces were still heavy with flesh, their ribs padded, their eyes innocent. They were older than we, an average 25 to our average 20, yet we treated them like children. I remember when two of them, having heard of the Ilu, immediately set off for it, picking their way through the barbed wire like botanists off on a field trip. I shouted at them to come back. I cannot say exactly why I shouted. Perhaps because they seemed not to show the proper respect for danger. The barbed wire seemed to them an obstacle course. The enemy jungle a picnic ground. Their curiosity was childlike. Their very backs bespoke trust. And they mocked my own dark memories of this island. "Get the hell back here," I shouted. And they returned. Their officer said, "What's wrong?" And I replied, with exaggerated concern, "Some bombs landed out there. They may be delayed action." He was gratified and thanked me. Thank God for somebody who knows these things. It made me feel like a prig. So we said goodbye. We left them in the fields. We let them take possession of our magnificent field of fire, and our solid pits, and our precious sleeping sacks of rope, our barbed wire and the Ilu, and we climbed onto waiting trucks. We had lived on the sands of the beach and mud of the riverbank, the trampled kunai of the fields, and now we were going to the coral of the ridges. Up, up and up we went, around and around, climbing roads that seemed to coil about our ridge like a spiraling serpent, until we came to the uppermost level and they told us to get down. That was how we came to the ridge. 5. The ridge rose like the backbone of a whale from the dark and wind-tossed sea of the jungle around us. It rose to command a panoramic view, not only of the bay, but of all northern Guadalcanal. Lieutenant Ivy League was urging us on, half-trotting in front of us, as though he were the football coach coming onto the field before the lumbering equipment-laden varsity. He led us down to the extreme southern point of the whale, where the snout curved down into the jungle. We had been given an extra machine gun to operate. He divided our squad into two. Chuckler, you take one. Lucky, you take the other. Urgency seemed to pitch his voice higher, and we became concerned. See, he said, pointing out over the jungle. That's Grassy Knoll. Someone snickered. Anyway, if we never get to it, we can always say we saw it. The lieutenant bit his lip and said, Intelligence says the Japs are massing out there. They're expected tonight. Now he had no difficulty with his audience. This is where the raiders and the paramarines held them. But they may try here again. That's why you've got the extra gun. He turned to glance down into the jungle. That's the trail to Grassy Knoll down there. No one spoke, and he motioned for me and my squad to follow. We jumped down the side of our ridge spur, a sheer 6-foot drop. The lieutenant pointed to a sort of low cave dug in the side of the hill. Put your gun in there, he said, and left, promising to send warm chow before nightfall. It was a trap. It was a trap, trap, trap. It was a blind eye, an evil eye, a cyclopean socket glaring out of the side of the clay-red hill down into the choked ravine whence even now night drifted toward us. We looked at each other. Okay, I said. Let's get the gun in there. We set the gun up wordlessly, but there was no room for more than two men, myself and my assistant. He was Cincinnati, a blonde, square, smooth-talking Ohioan, who was to distinguish himself in Australia by lending his comrades money at 10%. The others, Runner, Oakstump, Red the medical corpsman, and Amish the Pennsylvania Dutchman, scattered out on the hillside. I could hear them inching up it, getting farther and farther away from the trap. I said nothing. Who could blame them? I felt like a man with his arms pinioned. It was impossible to fight from our position. They would be upon us before we knew it. The file of little brown men padding up the trail would burst upon us from but a few yards away. Should we repel them, it would be the shock of but a moment. Our cave was so poorly concealed, so poorly chosen, a hand grenade would finish us at the first try. They would hardly need to take aim. If they came tonight, we would die in our postage stamp machine gun pit. We could not get away. Worse, we could not stop them. We could not even give them pause. It is one thing to die, another to die uselessly. Night was upon us. We sat in the blackness, the sound-enhancing stillness, listening to our own breathing like a dying man feeling for his pulse, starting at the sound of the earth crumbling softly around us. Below, the jungle stirred uneasily. We began to curse. Softly, ever softly. We cursed the stupidity of the officer who had laid out the lines, the thoughtlessness of Ivy League. We cursed things singly or in pairs, generally or in the particular. And when we had done, when we had drawn off the venom of hopelessness, I turned to Cincinnati and said, Start tearing the gun down. We're getting the hell out of here. We'll move up on top of the hill. I don't know about you, but I'm not planning to die without a fight. He whispered, You can say that again, and began to take the gun apart, while I crawled out of the cave to warn the men on the hillside. I called softly to them, Runner, Amish. That you, Lucky? It was Amish, surprise and just a tinge of suspicion in his voice. Yeah, it's me. Look, we're coming up. We're bringing the gun up on top of the hill. It's a trap down here. Keep us covered while we move, and tell Runner to warn Chuckler and the others so they won't shoot at us. He whispered, Okay. And I crawled back inside the cave. I said to Cincinnati, You take the gun in the water can, and I'll take the tripod in the ammo box. He said nothing. And then I whispered, Let's go. We didn't bother to try to crawl out with our cumbersome gear. We kicked out the sandbags protecting the cave mouth and scrambled out and up and away from that claustrophobic pit. We were sweating when we had done setting up the gun again. But it was with relief. There was elbow room. Now a man might fight. But we had become unstrung. Not 10 minutes later, I leaned forward and laid a hand on Cincinnati's arm, thinking I heard movement below and to the left. When I thought I heard a sibilant command like, "Over here," I whispered, "Here they come," and snicked the gun bolt. We waited for the little brown men, for the silhouette of the mushroom helmet against the black bulk of the jungle, but no one came. No one came all night, though we heard gunfire and the smash of mortars. In the morning we learned that the attack had come against the army, against the very unit that had replaced us that day. They sat in our great big pits, behind our barbed wire and our field of fire, and they massacred the Japs. We felt disappointed. Not that they had not come against us on the ridge, but that we had not been in the fields to mow them down. We were glad they had not hit us on the ridge. Exposed as we were, they would have swept over us, though we might have held them up. We learned that morning, too, that we had been expendable for the evening. "Didn't you know?" asked one of the other gunners who was stationed farther back on the ridge. "We were under orders to shoot anything that came up the hill." "Yeah? Supposing we came up. Supposing it got too hot and we pulled back." The man shrugged. "What do you think we would do? Ask to see your Liberty card? We'd have shot your ass off, that's all." Hoosier's eyes went big and he swore indignantly. "Well, I'll be go to hell." No one criticized me for moving the gun. Lieutenant Ivy League agreed to it when I showed him that from the spur, we could command the entire trail of plunging fire, as well as the ravines below it, and that we also might set up a crossfire of the gentleman's gun, above and beyond up to the right. Also, should my gun be overrun, the gentleman could deliver a plunging fire into it. What a fortress we made of that ridge snout! We stripped the sides of the ravines of their cover. We leveled plateaus and covered them with barbed wire. We sowed the remaining jungle with booby traps fashioned with hand grenades. We filled gallon cans of gasoline and fastened these to trees at points where our guns had been sighted in, so that we could fire incendiary bullets into them and set them alight. We got 105mm shells from the artillery and buried them in the jungle, preparing them for detonation by electric wires running down from our pits. We dug rifle holes between the pits, and later, trenches running from hole to hole to pit, so that the ridges commanded by our guns and the riflemen of G Company were honeycombed with fortifications. Finally, we explored the jungle front for all the flat ground, where the enemy might be most inclined to set up mortars or machine gun fire, or where an attack might most likely be mounted. And these we registered with our guns, sighting in on them, each man carefully measuring his own hand span, so that he could fire at night and hit the target. All the while, a terribly bright sun beat down on us. There was not a single tree on the ridge. We had no shade, except to duck into the pits, and by mid-afternoon even these had become unbearable. Sweat streamed from us and the ulcers yawned on our hands and legs. What bitter, desperate anger at the sight of blood from a barbed wire prick, and the hopeless foreknowledge of the flies that would be upon it. Only constant motion kept the greedy, filthy flies away. High as we were not too high for them. We had outclimbed the mosquitoes, but the flies fed on us unceasingly. Sometimes the pus built up painful pressures, whereupon Red, our corpsman, would draw a pitted, rusty scalpel from his kit and probe the wound. He would look at a particularly wicked sore and whistle, "Whew! How long you had this one?" "About a week." "That's so," he would inquire mildly, like a man discussing his neighbor's zinnias, and then drive his knife into the sore with all the verve of the man who likes his work. Brick, from my squad, suffered terribly from the ulcers. His legs were thick with them. He suffered from the heat, too, as did Red. It was an ordeal for both of them, both having the fairest skin to match their flaming hair and light blue eyes, but they reacted differently. Brick succumbed. Each day when the sun reached its zenith, he retired to the pit and lay with his face against the cool water cans, a wet piece of cloth on his brow. Sometimes he passed out, or became so exhausted he was unable to move. Only assignment to working parties at cooler points on the lines, or blessed visitation from the rain saved him from his daily agony. Red became a mole. He kept his helmet forever jammed down over his eyes, and covered his body as though he were in the Arctic. He withdrew within himself. He ceased to talk to us, except to dispense medical counsel with an aplomb rivaled only by an outrageous ignorance of his subject, or else to carry on a sort of frantic monologue concerning his chances of being assigned to duty near his hometown of Utica, should he survive Guadalcanal. But that helmet, he wore it always. He wore it for fear of the heat and for fear of the bombs. He slept with it on. He bathed with it on. It was not uncommon to see him, standing in the middle of the stream near E Company's lines to our rear, his body ridiculously white, his helmet on. To mention it to him, to shout, "Red, take that damned helmet off," was to draw a look of animal hatred. Under the helmet, his face became small and sharp and hateful, like an animal with pointed teeth. Soon the helmet became a fixation with us. We wanted it off. It was a sign that Red was going loco. And after him, who? We schemed to rid ourselves of it. "The only thing we can do is shoot it full of holes," said Chuckler. We were squatting on the hillside, where we always did, midway between the Chuckler's pit and mine. Red sat apart from us, mole-like, his helmet slumped over his inward-looking eyes. Hoosier reflected and grinned slyly. "Who's gonna do the shooting?" "Me," said the Chuckler. "Oh, no, you're not. We'll draw straws." The Chuckler protested, but we outvoted him. It made no difference. He won the draw. The plan was for Runner to engage Red in conversation, while I came up behind him and knocked off his helmet. Chuckler was to spray it with machine gun bullets while it rolled down the hill. Runner strolled over and sat down beside Red, wondering out loud if it would be possible, once we were delivered from Guadalcanal, to obtain a soft billet upstate. Red immediately shifted the venue to Utica and the question to his heart. I stole up behind him and knocked off his helmet. Chuckler's gun gave roaring, stuttering voice. The twin shocks of the loss of his helmet and the sound of the gun sent Red to his feet as though from a spring released. He clutched his head, his unkempt flaming mop, as though the top of it had gone off with the helmet. There was terror on his face. Everyone was jumping, waving his arms and whooping. "Let her go, Zeke! Yip, 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 yahoo! Hey, Red, too bad your silly head ain't in that helmet. Shoot her, Chuck. Shoot the sides out of the blasted thing. Woo-hoo!" Filled with holes, the helmet rolled out of sight beneath the hill. Runner yelled to the Chuckler to cease fire and dashed down to retrieve it, setting it atop a barbed wire pole where it was shot into a sieve. Then it was brought up the hill and flung at Red's feet. He gazed at it in horror. He turned to look at us, and there was not even hatred in his eyes, only gathering tears and the dumb pleading look of the animal that has been beaten to the ground. We had half hoped that he would laugh, but he wept and ran up the hill to the battalion aid station. There he stayed until a new helmet was found for him, and he could be persuaded to return to our pits. When he did, his manner was more distant than ever, and his chin strap was never again undone. Nor did anyone dare joke with him about the time we shot his helmet into bits. It was November. 3 months and more since we had landed. The Japanese had been coming at our division perimeter all of October, it seemed, always attacking over a narrow front, penetrating slightly during the night, and then, in the morning, being driven back with terrific loss. Yet they kept coming. Hardly a battalion of our three infantry regiments, 1st, 5th, and 7th, had not fought its battle. So had the doggies of the 164th Regiment. But the Japanese kept coming. We could see them sometimes, pouring off the beach transports down at Kokumbona. Sometimes the old Aero Cobras would rise off the field and lumber down to the transports to bomb and strafe them. We cheered and danced as they passed overhead, en route to the carnage. We watched fascinated as the Aero Cobras dived to strafe or to release their bombs in that slow, yawning, dreadful parabola. But they kept coming. They had heavy artillery now. At the Matinacau River, they used heavy tanks. They kept coming in our lines. Kept being thrown back, but every night we expected them. Time had become a terrible, catchy rhythm, like the breathing of a child frightened by sounds in the dark. Each night we held our breath. The men of the 1st Marine Division and the soldiers who had joined us, on the ridges, in the ravines, looking seaward from the beach, guarding the rivers, crouching in airport shelters, all held their breath like a single, giant organism, harking for the sounds of the intruder in the dark. Each morning we released it, a long, slow, silent exhalation. They kept coming. With them came more and more of their airplanes, winging in from Rabaul, silvery and bright, like flying fish high up in that most blue sky. Sometimes, before or after the bombers had dropped their loads, dogfights would growl over our ridge so close that it seemed we had only to put out a hand to touch the combatants. From such a melee one day, a Zero took to playing with us, strafing us. Chuckler became so angry he dragged his gun out of the pit and set it up to return the fire. He was aware of the difficulty of hitting a streaking Zero by firing a puny 30-caliber machine gun over open sights, yet he could not bear huddling in the pit while the Jap made sport of us. He swore at the Zero as it banked gracefully, and he struggled to get his gun in position, shouting at me, "Come on, Luck, give me a hand!" I ran to assist him, but the Zero had turned and was coming back. Before I could reach him, it was upon us with a roar. Seeing the puffs of dust its bullets kicked up, hearing the musical tinkle of its empty shells falling on the ridge, I turned and ran. Chuckler had sprawled flat. I ran. It was behind me, roaring, spitting, tinkling. I jumped off the hillside above the cave which I had abandoned the first night. I heard it roar over me before I hit the ground 6 feet below. Atop the hill, Chuckler was cursing wildly. I scrambled back up, helped him to get the gun erect and loaded, and squatted beside him to feed it. We waited for the Zero's return. It banked and made for us. "Come on, you son of a bitch," Chuckler growled. "You won't find it so easy this time." The tinkling had begun again. The dust puffs were dancing toward us. Our gun was hammering, when, from behind the ridge, appeared two Aero Cobras flying wingtip to wingtip, and the Zero disappeared. I say it disappeared. I suppose it blew up, disintegrated under the impact of the cannon which the Aero Cobras mounted in their nose, but I heard no explosion, perhaps because by then our ridge had become a perfect cauldron of sound. What with the dogfighting, the bombing of the airport, and the answering wham of the airport anti-aircraft guns. It was the AAA guns that gave us as much pause as did the enemy. Most of their flak bursts were directly overhead, and often our ridge would sound like a xylophone registering the falling shrapnel. We took cover, as much from fear of this brimstone rain as from enemy bombs or bullets. It was not pleasant to be walking the ridge, far removed from cover, and to see the beautiful enemy host approaching and the black shell clusters popping into sight around them, and then to hear the rattling of the shrapnel. On a clear day in mid-November, I passed through the battalion command post, just as condition red was shouted, just as the bombers, flying very high in a tight V, appeared in the sky. Our anti-aircraft threw up a black cloud of explosive, forcing them to veer off and to jettison their bombs, which crashed harmlessly in the jungle. Soon I was alone. Everyone had gone below ground. I ran from hole to hole seeking admittance, but all were full. At last, I came to the officer's shelter dug in the hillside. With the fragments falling around me in a chilling fugue, I swept back the burlap over the entrance and gazed into the unblinking, formidable glass eye of Captain High Hips. What disdain! It was as though the holder of a coach ticket had sought to enter a parlor car. His hostility was as curt as a slap in the face. In that moment, I hated High Hips and all his class. I muttered an apology and let the burlap fall back in place. I retired to the solitude of the ridge and the rain of shrapnel, vowing, "Let me rather die out here than be tolerated down there." But I was not scratched. Only my sensitivity suffered. Souvenirs reappeared while we were on the ridge. I had not seen him since the Teneroo. He was now one of a half dozen sharpshooters serving as regimental scouts. At intervals of a week or so, he could descend into the jungle on an expedition to Grassy Knoll. With him was an old-time Marine sergeant, a blocky, taciturn ancient with wild, bushy red hair and an enormous red beard that gave him the appearance of Hell's Santa Claus. He never spoke while they moved down our hill with braked step, but Souvenirs loved the banter, which his presence provoked.
"Hey, Souvenirs, got your pliers?"
Souvenirs grinned, tapping his rear pocket.
"You know me, boys. I'd sooner forget my rifle." "How about it, Souvenirs? I'll give you $10 for that Bull Durham sack around your neck." "Yeah, I know what you mean. How about a pint of my blood, too, huh?" "How many teeth you got in that sack?"
"That's my business."
"100? Guess again, boy. Guess up a storm."
Grinning crookedly beneath his handlebar mustache, Souvenirs disappeared into the jungle. But his famous Bull Durham sack full of Japanese gold teeth had left his admirers engaged in excited speculation. "I wonder how many gold teeth the sucker really has in his sack."
"I don't know, but a fellow from his old squad in F Company says he got 50 of them from Hell's Point alone. That was 3 months ago, and he's been going out on those patrols pretty steady since then. He's got at least 75 of them gold teeth in that sack."
"Must be a couple $1,000 worth. Hell's fire! I like to have that when we get back to the States. I'd get me a hotel room and a..."
"What the hell makes you think you're gonna see the States again? Where do you think we're going when we get off of here?"
"Another island, that's where. Anybody thinks he's gonna see the States again is crazy as hell. They'll have your ass on another landing so fast you won't know whether to sweat or to draw small stores. Ain't nobody around here gonna see the States, not for a long time anyway, unless he gets carried back."
"Ah, blow it."
We were growing irritable. Our strength was being steadily sapped, and a sort of physical depression afflicted many of us. Often a man expended his whole strength going to chow, working his way down the slippery hill to the galley tent set in a ravine, and then climbing back up it. Sometimes, if the rain had been especially heavy, a man might skip chow, just forget about it, even though his belly might be growling. The hill would be too slippery. The rain. The rainy season was upon us. On our exposed ridge it fell upon us in torrents. A man was drenched in seconds, his teeth chattering and his hands darting swiftly to his precious cigarettes, transferring them to the safety of his helmet liner, cursing bitterly if he had waited too long before becoming conscious of their peril. After cigarettes, we were concerned about our ammunition. On the downward slope of the hill, the rainwater ran into our pits and holes as though they were sewer receivers. We had to dash for the pits and lift the boxes of machine gun belts out of the water's way, piling them atop one another on the earthen gun platform. Any dry place in the pit was reserved for ammunition. He who sought refuge from the rain had to sit on the water cans. There were whole days of downpour when I lay drenched and shivering, gazing blankly out of my hole, watching as the sheeted gray rain whipped and undulated over the ridge. At such times, a man's brain seems to cease to function. It seems to retreat into a depth, much as the red corpuscles retreat from the surface of the body in times of excitement. One ceases to be rational. One becomes only sentient, like a barnacle clinging to a ship. One is aware only of life, of wetness, of the cold gray rain. But without this automatic retreat of reasons, a man can only go one way. He can only go mad. Barnacle-like, I had made a discovery during the downpour. I had found that even in wetness, there was warmth. I was the only one on the ridge with a cot. I placed it in my hole. Over this, I had stretched a poncho on which I had sprinkled dirt. We were not permitted so much as a stick above the ground for fear the enemy might find a target. I ditched my hole, and there were times when my homemade drainage and my poncho combined to keep me dry. But when it rained heavily or persistently, I was done. The hole filled with water which rose right through my cot and soaked me. At times, I might be lying in an inch or so of water with a foot of water beneath my cot. It was cold and went right to the bone because the intense heat had made our blood so thin. At last, in disgust, I hauled my cot out on the hillside. The hell with it! Let the Jap shoot. If that near-sighted creature could see through the rain, if he was so stupid as to want to.